Have it all under control, Raymond.
Cameron.
Good morning, Rhiannon. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm excellent. My only problem is my co-host, Ray, is MIA. I'm going to call him MIA Ray from now on.
What time is it where he is?
7 p.m.
Okay.
Yeah, and...
So he might not have got home yet, maybe.
Nah, he should be home. But he lives in some backwoods town in Virginia. But I just assume he's forgotten. But it has given me plenty of time to practice this for you.
Oh, please don't do that.
I'm sure you get that a lot, but how many people play it for you live on a podcast?
No, nobody has ever done that before.
See, special.
Mostly they say, like the song.
Yeah. See, I just skipped that bit, went straight to playing the song for you.
Yeah. Well, I like to think that it was named after me because I'm afraid I am older than it.
Really? Oh. And your parents knew Stevie Nicks. Do you ring like a bell in the night? I think that's what we all want to know.
I don't even know what that means.
Me either. I do not know what that means. I play that song a lot and I no idea. Anyway. I don't think I've done enough drugs, Rhiannon, to really understand what that means.
Maybe that's the problem.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Rhiannon Evans from La Trobe University. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your expertise rather than me trying to tell it for you? What are you an expert in, Rhiannon?
I work in Roman literature, so I'm an expert in Latin, and I guess up until fairly recently, I've worked most closely on Roman imperial literature, but I've started getting very interested in Julius Caesar and the late Republic. So I'm moving backwards.
And you've done a 7-episode podcast series on Caesar just recently too, which I've listened to. It's excellent work.
Thank you.
Hosted by Matt Smith, but not that Matt Smith, apparently.
No, there's a lot of name confusion. No, Matt's an excellent interviewer, and also in conjunction with, a couple of them, with one of my colleagues, Sarah Midford, who, particularly on Caesar's triumph, because she's interested in kind of the pomp of the triumph. So we had a three-way chat when we were talking about Caesar coming back to Rome.
And do you tell people I had a three-way with Matt Smith? Is that... When you go to Comic-Con, is that...
That would really annoy Matt's wife.
I was watching a video with you and Sarah on Cicero and Catullus this morning over coffee, actually.
That's actually with another colleague, Sonia Worster.
Oh, different Sonia. Did you say Sonia?
A Sarah and a Sonia.
Oh, Sarah and Sonia. Sorry, yeah. Sonia.
Yeah, Sarah has actually done one, which was with our professor, Chris Mackey, on Troy. So Sarah's up there too if you want to find her. But the vodcast, I guess, that I did on Cicero and Catullus was with Sonia Worster from the University of Melbourne. So we've got all kinds of things out there. Mostly on the late Republic, but I'm actually starting, they're not out there yet, but I'm starting with Matt a new series on the emperors. So we're going from Caesar and we're working forward.
Excellent.
So we've done Augustus.
Well, I'm trying to conference Ray in now because apparently he is remembered. Hello, Ray. I need you, Raymond.
Sorry, Ray is here. I am terribly sorry.
Yeah, you're terribly late too. Say hello to Rhiannon, Ray.
Hello, Rhiannon, Ray. How are you?
I'm Ray. I'm very pleased to hear you.
Now, Ray, you missed my big intro, which was... Rhiannon liked it, but you weren't here for it, man.
I apologize for that too.
Yeah, well, do you have a song? Does Cameron play a song for you?
Yes, I do actually. It's Jesse's girl, but I can't remember how that goes right now.
Right.
Rhiannon, well, let's start again now that Ray's here. We'll kick it off. Rhiannon has just introduced herself. Ray, I'll edit all this and make it sound really clever and switched on later on.
Yes, thank you.
So, Rhiannon, you're an expert in the literature and the linguistics of the period. And I have to say, so are Ray and I. If there's one thing that we are well known for, it's our Latin pronunciation.
Right. We do have a reputation.
That's true.
Which way does that reputation go?
Not well. Not well at all, I'm afraid.
Let's not focus on the details.
Let's say for the first few episodes, I was calling Pompey Pompeii. And people, you know, started screaming at me. And I said, hey, I'm an Aussie and, you know, we're allowed to pronounce things badly.
You know, you're actually in good company because you know that the first inscription from Pompeii was discovered, I think, in the 16th century. And whoever discovered it thought it was just a reference to Pompey the Great and didn't really bother digging any further.
That's so hilarious.
There's a long tradition of confusing the two. So I think you should be proud.
All my life. I pronounced it Pompeii until people told me I was pronouncing it wrong.
Wow.
Shut up. You're supposed to be the nice one.
Sorry.
So, Rhiannon, I wanted to start off by asking you, I was reading one of your papers, Barbarian Nation, on some of these terms. Where we're up to in our linear series, we're deep into Caesar's pre-consulship of Gaul. And one of the things I've been fascinated with while we've been going through the commentaries of the Gallic Wars is just how edifying Caesar seems to be of many of the people he's fighting. Particularly, we just covered his second invasion of Britain. And I was noting to Ray that he didn't really say anything negative about the tribes that he was fighting there. He was fairly edifying even of them. But we do have this term barbarians, and I think we talked in an earlier show about the root of it coming from Babel, I think the Greeks. Is that correct?
There is a theory that that's the case, that it refers to anyone who doesn't speak Greek because it sounds like bar-bar. So it's a word that for the Greeks originally just meant other people. It didn't have a negative connotation. But by the time it gets to the 5th century and the Greeks are dealing with the Persians, and certainly by the time the Romans take the word on, it does mean, you know, pre-civilized. It almost means savage. So you can't use it without implying that we are more civilized, we're superior. And Caesar does use it. He doesn't use it often of the Gauls, but he does use it occasionally, especially in towards the end of the Gallic Wars when things are coming to a head. He uses it a lot of the Germans, or as I like to call them, the Germani, because they're not really anything to do with the present-day Germans. But, I think he uses it to distinguish the two in a lot of ways.
Right. I'm getting a lot of mic noise. I'm sorry. Ray, are you doing something with your microphone there?
No, I am not being a barbarian. I would never do that to you, Cam.
I did mean to ask you at the start, Cameron. I'm doing this on my iPad, and I failed to find a microphone.
Oh, well, you sound excellent.
Am I okay? Yeah. All right. I'm just kind of holding it here in front of me because my cat's actually sitting on my lap. This is not ideal. I'm on leave. Even at the moment, so I'm doing this at home.
Wow.
But you'll have to edit all of this out, so I'll shut up.
No, which iPad are you doing it on? This is amazing how clear this is.
It's not the most recent. I think it's an iPad 2.
Right, I've got a 2. I never thought of it. You've changed my podcasting forever. well, I was getting, during what you're talking there, a lot of, I don't know, noisy sounds. So it might have been... You're a bit close to the mic, maybe. Might be blowing into it or something. Or it could be your cat's tail rubbing on the microphone.
No, I think the problem is she's on my lap, so I had to hold the iPad. So I'm afraid I've kicked her off and now it's on my lap. Is that any better?
Well, it sounds very clean now. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Definitely the cat, yeah.
It was the cat's fault.
Sorry. The cat's fault.
Okay, so I just wanted to... ask you about the Germani for a second before we move on. You said not related to the Germans. Who are they related to, if anyone?
Well, I prefer to avoid using Germans because there has been a nasty tradition of relating them directly back to the Germani. And by nasty, I mean, you know, people like Hitler wanted to make use of this to say we are naturally a tough people. Right. So the borders are slightly different anyway. Of course, the borders of Germany have changed over time. And it's easy to talk about the Gauls, and you know you're not directly talking about the French because it's a different name. But I just like to avoid the confusion between Germans and ancient Germani. I'm not saying that people have moved around so much that there is no relationship between them.
Right.
But they're not culturally related to them. I mean, the time has been so very distant. Also, I think the Germani are pretty much a creation of Caesar's in Caesar's writings. So we don't really have any archaeological evidence that backs up anything he says. And you know, people have been quite annoyed with Caesar because they can't just dig up Iron Age Germany, areas north of the Rhine, and find exactly what he says. Because he says they didn't have any gold, they don't have many metals, they don't practice agriculture. Well, that doesn't seem to be true. And I think it's a cultural distinction that he wants to make between the Gauls and the Germani, but it's not really one that we can back up with any good evidence.
Well, this brings up an interesting subject because we talk a lot on the show about how much we should take on... I shouldn't have dropped that. How much we take on faith. We should take on faith from Caesar's commentaries. It being our only source of a lot of the events, we're always saying, okay, we need to take this with a grain of salt, and yet we believe it was fairly well accepted as being relatively balanced in his era. Would you agree with that?
Well, I kind of doubt it was, actually. I'm sure it was read as a propaganda text for Caesar. Of course, Caesar won, so we don't have the other side talking much about it. The only other voice we have is Cicero's, and just occasionally he'll refer to what Caesar's doing in Gaul in his letters, and he's very kind of gung-ho about Caesar at the time, even though he ends up on the other side. I don't think that all of the Romans would necessarily have believed every word of Caesar, because, of course, it paints him in a glowing light. On the other hand, we're really lucky to have a text that was written by someone who was there on the spot. I mean, this is very, very rare for a commander to write about his own exploits. Normally, if you think about, say, who we've got writing about the events that happened after the death of Augustus, well, they're written by Tacitus 100 years later. You know, he's not as close to the events by any means. So we're very lucky to have the text of a commander who was there. I don't think that means that we necessarily have to believe everything Caesar says, but it's a really interesting text because he gets to give his own version. And we can be suspicious of that and think about what his motives were. But lots of people wrote this kind of thing and we've lost most of them, but we've got Caesar's texts. So, you know, they're a great resource.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you think about it. I mean, it's so subtle that we should probably say from now on, okay, this is what Caesar said happened, as opposed to reporting it as history, because he doesn't trash everybody. You think he's being fair and balanced, but he's in a very subtle way. You know what I'm saying?
It was the Fox News.
It was the Fox News. That's right.
Of 53 BCE. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, I like. It's a bit more literary, but anyway.
Yeah.
He was making shit up, but he wasn't that bad.
Right.
He was only Julius Caesar, the dictator for life. He wasn't Fox News.
But also he was known to be a really good writer and speaker. And I'm sure you know, Cicero says if he hadn't gone off to be a commander, then he could have been a great orator, which I'm sure from Cicero's point of view is, you know, what a lost opportunity. But he was very good with words. So, you know, you read it and enjoy it because he was so good at writing.
Do you know if Pompey, I thought I read somewhere, and I apologize, don't know the source. I thought I read somewhere that Pompey kind of picked up on Caesar's thing and had someone writing stuff, following him around and writing, you know, covering his campaigns. Do you know if Pompey had someone writing something up for him, some good propaganda?
He had memoirs, which is often the word that we use for Caesar's work, which is commentaries, commentary, is what people used for their memoirs too. But we don't have a single one except Caesar's. So, you know, Sulla had them. Lots of people wrote their memoirs. Wow. We don't have them. It's very sad.
Was Sulla's called Don't Make Me Pull a Sulla? Do you know?
It should have been.
I think it was just called Commentarii, unfortunately. Really? They weren't really into titles. Well, and, you know, the title of a work was often just the first few words of it, so you got to choose your first words carefully.
That was the subtitle. Don't Pull a Sulla is the subtitle.
Yes.
I think that was his first words, Why I Had to Pull a Sulla by Sulla. So let's get back to Barbarian and Barbarous Natio. Mm. I was reading in this paper of yours, you made the interesting point that the those sorts of terms, tribe, barbarian, today have a certain connotation that they didn't have in Caesar's day. Can you explain that a little bit further for us?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the word tribe because it's one that got used in anthropology in English language texts, and I think that it's a word that's a bit more difficult to use these days. It's got those overtones of very, very primitive and, you know, sort of the era of colonialism is still a bit close for us to be comfortable with it. But I don't think it's always the wrong word to use to translate the word natio. Sometimes people use nation, which is also a bit of a difficult word because it means nation state and they didn't exist in antiquity. But sometimes when Caesar uses the word natio, tribe might be the right word because he is being quite patronizing, or more often the person that he's quoting is being patronizing, because as I'm sure in your reading you notice that he often has other Gauls speak and give information about Gauls or the Germani. So he's often kind of, as I like to call it, ventriloquizing them and giving us the Gallic version, which he probably made up quite often. Maybe not so much when their speech is to him, but say when he happens to know what Vercingetorix says to rally his troops just before the vital battle. Well, right. Doubt very much that he knew what Vercingetorix said, but there's a long and noble tradition of making up the speeches of the enemy, and in fact making up the speeches of Romans for that matter. So the Roman historians didn't really worry about that too much. So I think quite often Caesar's giving vent to his own, you know, abilities as a speech maker when he does that. So I think that, yeah, sometimes he's using this language to show us what what the Gauls thought of each other, or what they thought of the Germani, and that he paints a picture where the Gauls think the Germani are, you know, they're people that you don't really want to have to deal with. They're rough and they're uncivilized. They don't trade. They don't plant stuff. They're kind of below the Gauls in lots of ways.
But surely all of the bits where he says the chieftains of the Gallic tribes were coming and there was bowing down to him on their knees, begging forgiveness, lots of crying and gnashing of teeth, wailing and gnashing, that's all real. But he didn't make any of that stuff up.
That tends to happen at the end of pretty much every book. Something out and they come to him.
There was wailing and gnashing of teeth.
There probably was. I mean, he was an utterly ruthless leader, hence his success. And I'm sure that did happen.
He had no ruth. I'm getting the sense that you find his description of the Gallic, Germanic and British tribes more disparaging than I do when I read them. Do you find that he talks condescendingly about them, or is he trying to be somewhat accurate in your view?
Well, I don't mean to sound like he thinks they're all barbarians, but I think he does have a strong case of Roman superiority. And I think Caesar's actually at a bit of a kind of a point where things are starting to change in the way the Romans write about other people, which is quite hard to prove because he is one of the earliest ones we have. So you just have to bear with me here. But you're right. He does write about the Gauls and the Britons, at least in fairly neutral terms. And he'll praise some of them, But one of the reasons he praises some of them and not others is, as he's constantly telling us, the Gauls are really disunited. They can't get it together. I mean, in that big description where in book 6 of the Gallic Wars, he goes into this is what the Gauls are like. The first thing he says is they're all factionalized. There's so many factions. And that, I think there he's telling us what we see all the way through the text. They try and form an alliance, but it falls apart. The very last thing that, you know, happens in book 7, Vercingetorix, they form this alliance, but it doesn't really last. People don't trust Vercingetorix. So they've kind of got this chronic case of they can't get themselves together, which I think we can read between the lines and say, therefore, they need the Romans to come in and unify them. And we'll do that by creating provinces. Whereas the Germani, I think he does paint as kind of rabble, that they don't have any of the markers of civilization. They wear skins, they feed on meat and milk, you know, they don't do agriculture, they're nomadic. He's making this strong distinction, which, as I mentioned, we don't have any evidence for this strong distinction between people either side of the Rhine. It's quite convenient that he paints them as very, very different. But I think that later on, if you read Tacitus's Germania, which is written about 150 years later, he paints the Germani as these kind of what we would call noble savage types. So they might be uncivilized, maybe deeply unpleasant to live that kind of lifestyle, but they don't have adultery and they're not traitorous and, you know, they don't have conspiracies and problems with their political regimes. So he's sort of using them as a counterpoint for Rome. Not so sure that Caesar's doing that. So I think that while he paints a reasonably neutral picture, he's got a different motivation to the one Tacitus has. Tacitus is very cynical about the Romans. For Caesar, I think it's more about creating a group of people who are kind of ripe for conquest. The Gauls aren't as powerful as they used to be. He actually tells us that the Gauls used to be superior to the Germani, but they're not anymore. Mm. There's not really any point in taking on the Germani. They don't have anything worth having. Whereas the Gauls, they're exactly the kind of people you can conquer. They're not unified. They've got stuff. Yeah. They could be kind of raised up to Roman levels. And there's a good reason for being there. And after all, he has to tell us there's a good reason for being there because he kind of goes into Gaul without getting any approval for it. He's not meant to be there. He's meant to be back in his province. Right. So I think a lot of the Gallic Wars is a justification for why he's in Gaul at all.
But isn't Gaul one of his provinces? I thought he had Transalpine Gaul, Cisalpine Gaul, and Illyricum.
He does. He has Transalpine Gaul, but it's only the bit that we call Provence now. So Provence. South, southeastern France. Sorry, I have to get my west and east guys clear in my head. which they call Provincia. So he's meant to be in what we think of as northern Italy. You're quite right, it's Alpine Gaul. Transalpine Gaul only means that little corner, Provence, and Illyricum, which he barely seems to bother with. But the whole of the rest of Gaul, you read the beginning of the Gallic Wars, he divides Gaul into three parts. And the three parts are not his province. He kind of leaves that out. So it's like he's delimiting, this is where I'm going to go. It's not actually the bit I'm meant to be in, which he doesn't mention. But this is going to be the new province. And 10 years later, he's made it the new province.
I always thought about those provinces there, Cisalpine Gaul and Transalpine Gaul. I always thought about it. If you had to walk from Rome to Spain, the route you would take through there, that's where the Romans made the province, just so they could keep that pathway, or those roads, if you will, in their possession and nice and safe. So they had to have that, the joining land in between the two. I want to go back to something that you were mentioning earlier. I have always found it fascinating that the Romans looked down on the Gauls and the Germani because they weren't as civilized as them, but the people to the east of the Rhine looked down on everyone else because they weren't like them. So it's all just a matter of being different. Oh, you farm or you raise crops or you husband your animals. Well, we just eat meat and slaughter and we fight all the time. So everybody is using their own point of view to look down on everyone else. And so when you have something like that, you're always going to have tensions and clash of cultures, which are going to lead to war. I've just always found that fascinating. No matter how bad or how good you've got it, you're going to think your way is the best and look down on everyone else.
And this is coming from an American.
Yeah.
Well, that was, one of my professors at university saying that to me really early on, and he had a whole West-East theory about it. And he actually used, he had taught in the States, and he used the United States as an analogy to say that, you know, people on the East Coast look down on the West Coast because they think they're soft and they've got this this lifestyle where they just hang out and on the beach and don't really get down to any hard work.
That's not true? Is that not true? No, I'm just joking.
That's how people in Melbourne think about people in Queensland too, isn't it, Rhiannon? Honestly.
Yeah, the slower lifestyle, I guess so. Yeah.
I lived in Melbourne for 20 years. I know exactly how we think of Queenslanders.
And I think that we partly base it on climate, that because it's hot there, you know, and humid in Queensland, you just want to kind of hang around and not move too quickly. I don't know if that's true, but that's the sort of the theory, I think, whereas in Melbourne it rains a lot. So
all the happy clapper religions come out of the hot climates too. I think it does something to people's brains.
Maybe so.
But when Caesar's talking about the Germani tribes, he actually talks about them as being very good fighters, very brave. When he puts words in their mouths in the commentaries, he's talking about them being, you know, not being scared of the Romans. Leave us alone, or we'll come and kick your ass, Ariovistus, etc. And I imagine for a Roman in Caesar's time, saying that these tribes were very good fighters, very brave, very bold, was a compliment. It certainly would have been seen as complimentary, I think, back in the day. Even, of course, he beats them in the end, so the Romans are superior. I always get the sense that he's kind of building them up, maybe to make them appear as more of a threat than they really were, to justify his actions against them. But it always seems complimentary to me.
Yeah, I do think that in some ways ancient history texts have something in common with Hollywood movies, in that you've got to have an enemy worth fighting. Otherwise, what's the point? Because you get really bored if the movie was there's one army that's really strong and they just walk in there and trample over everyone. There's no tension. So I think that Caesar, like a lot of history writers, is very good at creating that tension. And also, if you think, always think about this as being aimed at a Roman audience, that I think there's an intention to make them feel like, how dare the enemy say that? How dare they come out and claim that they can beat us? And also coming out of that, you know, that tradition of oratory, which is very confrontational for the Romans, right? It's all about an opposition in the Roman law courts or in political speeches, that you get up and diss the enemy, diss the other side. I mean, they could say things in their political speeches that you'd get thrown out of the Australian Parliament for saying, for, you know, making imputations about somebody's sexuality or manliness. They're not even imputations, they just come right out and say them. So that people would throw, say, Caesar, for example, that he had been the boy of the king of Nicomedia, and that was always thrown at Caesar, and anybody who was his enemy would just come out and say that. So it's a very, he comes from a background that's sort of full of these ideas where you stand up and confront the enemy and you kind of shout nasty things at them. And I think he creates his own, the internal enemies in his writings to be like that. They come up and they give these kind of highly rhetorical speeches. So Ariovistus apparently is this savage Germani, and yet he can come up with these highly sort of shaped and cultivated speeches that mean you really need to have had the training that a Greek or a Roman would have had. So that's another reason for thinking that these are at the very least embellished speeches. And he's kind of got a point as well when he says to Caesar, well, you've got your bit of Gaul and I've got mine, so stay out of it. It's actually a decent argument.
But that's the fascinating thing. If we accept that Caesar's crafting these words and he's putting that decent argument in Ariovistus's mouth, I mean, that's a strange thing to do if you're trying to justify your side of the argument, to put a good argument in your opponent's mouth. Doesn't that seem strange?
It does seem strange. And I think that it's meant to sound arrogant. I think it might sound like a good argument to us. Mm. And really, I'm being a bit flippant saying that. Right. But, you know, Ariovistus doesn't really have his own bit of Gaul. He's meant to stay over the other side of the Rhine. And because he's a Germanus, he's sort of given up the right to be expanding, because what's he going to expand? Just more kind of rioting and not being able to farm land. And Caesar says twice that the greatest thing that the Germani think, you know, what shows power is to have an area of wasteland around your land. Wow. So that you kind of create this barren space between you and everyone else. Well, that's not something that the Romans are going to think is a good way to behave. So he might have highly rhetorical skills, and he might have lots of savage warriors on his side, but he doesn't really have a very good idea about how to create civilization. So he's sort of on the wrong side of the civilization debate.
Can I ask a question going back to something you said a couple of minutes ago? And this, I think, will just shed so much light on the Roman culture. Let's say that Caesar's always getting given a hard time about the thing with the king, Nicomedia. Was he expected just to take it and laugh because it was a part of the culture? Was it okay if he got upset and started swinging at somebody, or was it just part and parcel of what it meant to be a politician in Rome, and everybody got trash talked about something in their life? Was it just a part of the political landscape and you were expected to take it? Or if you got angry, does that maybe confirm that it's true? Whereas if you just kind of laughed it off, you were seen as maybe not innocent, but just, you know, being better than the other person who's accusing you.
Or if I can add to that, yeah, is it perhaps that our reading of the text takes it out of context? It, like Natio and Barbarus, is the fact that he was called Nicomedes' butt boy not insulting to him back then, as it might be to people today?
Right.
Oh, it's very, very insulting, but we don't have any record that he got annoyed by it. And in fact, his own troops used it in these bawdy rhymes during his triumph. And they basically said, you know, he used to be to use the language, butt boy of, you know, Nicomedes, but now he's kind of shoved it up the Gauls. So they had a way of turning it round, and I absolutely think you took it, but then you gave it right back to your that was the way of responding. Also, there is some evidence that Caesar was, there's lots of evidence that he was forgiving, of course. I mean, that was his big mistake, being so forgiving that there were people left around to murder him. But but Catullus, actually, if you watch that vodcast that Sonia and I did, I wasn't just thinking of spruiking that, but we talk in that about how Catullus wrote insulting poems about, kind of indirectly about Caesar, through writing about Mamura, who was his chief engineer. And he, instead of calling Mamura, he calls him Mentula, which means penis. So Catullus in these poems is insulting Mamura and insulting Caesar. And we're told by Suetonius that Caesar forgave Catullus. He didn't, you know, he didn't mind. He made up with him, as it were. So I think that the fact that Suetonius points that out perhaps means that some people didn't take it so well. But Caesar seems to have been the kind of person, and I guess he was in a good position to do this, in that he was highly successful. So, you know, it was just words, that it wasn't sticks and stones to him. He had the position of power, so he could afford for people to say a few nasty things about him. But he doesn't seem to have taken umbrage. And I think that's because that's a sign that you're a Roman man, that you can just take this and give it back.
Well, it's the same way I handle the negative reviews on iTunes that hate me. I just go, I'm the big man in Rome and you can all bite me.
I often get Cam and Caesar mixed up.
Oh, really?
I wanted to go back to something you were saying before about the way that Caesar would build up the Germani and the other tribes as having an enemy to fight against. And I can't help think about, again, the United States and their media and their politicians talking about whoever their big bad of the year is, ISIS, Saddam, Bin Laden, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Is that what we're looking at from a contemporary perspective, just having to have an enemy to rail against to justify imperialist expansions?
Yeah, except I guess there's an argument that, I mean, I do see the comparison there, and I think you're right that it's a way of unifying people. It's a kind of long understood tactic that you can unify your own people by having an enemy for us all to focus on. And, you know, politicians do that when things aren't going so well with the economy or just looks like they're not going to be elected again. But I guess there is a bit of a difference in that these days we don't feel entirely comfortable with the word colonialism and empire. So we usually try to dress it up a little bit differently. The Romans really didn't feel uncomfortable with having an empire. In fact, that was a source of glory. I mean, you can't imagine, you couldn't hold a triumph now. We have kind of versions of it, I suppose. We still have parades. But they, well, at least in Australia and I think in the States as well, they're often related to sports achievements. We have military parades, but they're not usually about conquest as such, are they? They're often about commemoration.
But Cato criticized Caesar for crossing the Rhine and tried to have his governorship taken away from him. So obviously not everybody in Rome thought it was okay just to have carte blanche invasions going on.
No, absolutely. And it is more nuanced than just the Romans were fine with going out there and conquering everybody. And Cato accused Caesar of declaring war on a group who were meant to be friends of Rome. So there are degrees because, of course, the Romans have got all of these different kinds of relationships with people throughout Europe. And it's not just the people within their empire. They've got these friends of the Roman people who are usually local kings, local leaders. And you're meant to, the pact is that they stay off your ground and you stay off theirs. And, you know, you might help them out depending on what the pact is. So he claimed that Caesar had breached that. But he wasn't successful, of course, in trying to bring Caesar to trial and to have the governorship taken away from him. So to a large degree, success kind of makes you immune from that, I suppose. Cato didn't have an awful lot of support in the Senate for that.
Yeah, if Caesar had a couple of armies wiped out, like we're talking about now, Cato maybe would have had a more stronger argument. But yeah, as long as you're winning, a lot of things get excused. And that's a very valuable lesson, boys and girls.
So, Rhiannon, I wanted to touch on something else you said about the the big lesson from Caesar is he was too forgiving. Can we sort of talk a little bit about your overall perspective of Caesar, his role in history, the lessons from his career? Is that one of the things that you think is a takeaway, that he was too nice?
Well, I don't think he was too nice. I think there are occasions on which he's extremely ruthless. I mean, if you think of what happened at Alesia, at the Siege of Alesia, where all the women and children and old people just get left straggling in no man's land, that's really calculated. They just starve to death. So, no, not always, and not by our standards at all. But I think it's a lesson that Augustus learned from Caesar, and he didn't leave anybody around to assassinate him. He got rid of anybody who was a threat. So in very much in Roman context, which is not at all the way that we would think it's acceptable to behave, yes, it's something I think about Caesar, that he knew he was very, very clever at playing the diplomatic and the political game, but he did make mistakes. And really he was kind of preparing the way for who would come next. And Augustus, because of what had happened to Caesar and because of the groundwork that Caesar had done in terms of, you know, sort of making it okay for one person to be in charge, Augustus learned those lessons and he played it perfectly. He really knew exactly how to behave, and he knew that because of Caesar.
Would it be fair to say, do you think when Caesar was being lenient, when he chose to be, was he just trying to be clever? Or do you think any part of him might have been reacting to what had come before him with all the bloodshed and slaughter between Marius and Sulla? There were so many Romans that had killed. Do you think he was trying to be different, or was he just thought he was being clever, being merciful when it suited him?
Well, I think that he's successful. He's kind of overcome everybody in 45 BC at a time when the Romans have been involved in civil war for decades and decades. And he really was trying to bring about reconciliation. So that's part and parcel of that. And I think, I guess in retrospect, which is very easy to say, he was rather naive. But it's kind of commendable in some ways that he thought he could do that. I guess you could read it as a sign of arrogance that he thought everybody would just say, okay, you can be dictator for life now. That's fine. And yeah, he did make some mistakes. That whole, you know, the idea that it would be okay for Antony to pretend to crown him and he'd turn it away. Everybody seems to read that as a blatant, this is Caesar trying to get rid of those rumors that he's a king, but it almost highlights it more.
Right.
He's not always clever about the way things are presented. Certainly Suetonius and other people were able to read those actions as ones that were PR errors, I suppose, at the very least.
Right.
But I think he really is trying to bring about reconciliation, yes. And it's, you know, he's very happy for everybody to be reconciled as long as they will recognize that he's the one and only person in control.
Reconciliation on his terms.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that a lot of these large characters in history believe in their own minds that they're doing the right thing and that everyone else will eventually come around to see that. I firmly believe that Hitler thought he was doing the right thing for the German nation, and I think Stalin probably thought he was doing the right thing for the Russians, or at least the Georgians. And I think the same with Caesar. I think he was pretty convinced that he was doing the right thing to stabilize the Republic after, you know, nearly a century of, you know, bloodshed and upheaval on a semi-regular basis, right. And that everyone else would come round and acknowledge. Particularly, we've been talking a bit on some recent shows about Cicero's Pro Marcello and how thick he lays it on. Oh, Caesar! Oh, what a guy! You're not just a guy; you're a god. I mean, if only my favorite bit is when he talks about the people who were fighting against Caesar in the Civil War. If they'd only known, Caesar, that you were such a good guy, they never would have done this in the first place. They were just ignorant of what a benevolent, marvelous, wonderful human being you are. Let me ask you: when you read Pro Marcello, do you take it as being genuine, or is he just taking the piss? Because I read it as him taking the piss completely. But I've read a different analysis of it.
I think Cicero is very, very complicated. And I think I changed my mind a lot about Cicero, which is appropriate because he changes his mind a lot. I think Cicero would be such a good person to psychoanalyze if that weren't a really bad idea to try to psychoanalyze someone who's been dead for over 2,000 years. But that he really doesn't know where to fit himself. And I think he's desperate to be part of a team, and he never is. So I'm not so sure that he's necessarily being entirely insincere. He wants to believe that Caesar will be someone who can sort of save Rome at certain times, I think. And he's sort of a much more natural fit, as you know, with the Republicans who he ends up with, But then in a lot of ways, they don't want him either. He doesn't come from the right family background. And of course, they're even more elitist than most Romans. So he's in a very, very difficult position. And I think there are times where he does genuinely think Caesar could be the man for the job.
But then, as soon as Caesar's
just being an opportunist, and in the end, you know, he is very brave, and he does end up being murdered for his beliefs.
Yeah, speaking out, yeah.
But as soon as Caesar's assassinated, he gets up and goes, "Look, if they had invited me, I would have been the first guy with the knife. Caesar was a dick." So, I mean,
exactly. That's what I mean. He really wavers back and forth.
Survivalist.
Yeah, and it didn't work.
Well, I mean, he survived a lot longer than many did.
I suppose so. But in some ways, this is a bit flippant, but I feel very sorry for Cicero because he's almost one of those politicians who's the kind of apex of his career comes so very early and then it's all downhill from there. Mm. Really, it's, you know, there's nothing good that happens after his consulship.
It's a story
that's
of my
meant
life.
To be the beginning. It makes me think of the British politician Tony Benn, who said all politicians' careers end in failure. It's just that mine ended a little bit sooner than most people's.
By the way, you don't need to apologise for being flippant on this podcast, Rhiannon. We take pride in the fact that we are the Flippant History Podcast.
That's right.
Okay. Well, proudly flippant. I think people enjoy that.
Apparently, some do, some don't.
Yeah.
So Cicero, yes. Where were we going before that? I got distracted.
Is he genuine? It's very hard to tell if Cicero's ever genuine. That's all I can say on Cicero.
He is at the moment.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about Caesar's legacy. So he forgave people. That's why I was thinking of Pro Marcello, because it was about him forgiving Marcellus. So forgiving people, what else in terms of his legacy do you think is important? How should he be remembered by our audience today? Why is he important in history?
Well, he's tremendously important in Roman history because he lays the groundwork for the imperial system. So, and this is something I try to impress on my students, not always successfully, that is the huge kind of gulf in Roman history, that change from republic to empire. And I think he's more than anybody responsible for that, even though he doesn't get to live to enjoy it, as it were. And he's kind of a giant of a figure, I suppose, because there's so many good stories about him, which most of which I like to believe are true, that he's such a charismatic figure. And I think that his writings bear that out. So he's kind of a successful politician and military figure because he's charismatic. And there are others from ancient history and beyond, but I think he's one of the great ones. He clearly knew how to communicate with people. So, you know, if you want to be a good people communicator as a politician, you should read Caesar. And he seems to have had a charmed life up until his death. All the great stories like Caesar and the pirates, why has nobody made a movie of this?
We're in production at the moment.
Exactly. I'm going to play a pirate. I'm very excited.
He is. I'm going to crucify him. I'm going to play Caesar.
And the fact that he stands up to Sulla when nobody else will really.
Right.
And, you know, I like to believe those early stories in particular because they paint him as this very brave character.
Swashbuckling.
Yeah, exactly.
But I was talking to somebody the other day and he said he knew nothing about Caesar, really. And I was trying to explain that, as you say, Caesar laid the groundwork for the Roman Empire. And the Holy Roman Empire, the impact that it had on the world for the next 1,800 years is massive. And it all happened as a result of, as you say, Caesar laying the groundwork for it. So his impact on history is unfathomable.
It is. And in a way, I suppose, it's very hard to argue alternate histories. I know people do, but I do sometimes think that if he hadn't come along and sort of inaugurated this system of monarchy, it's incredible to believe that the Romans were willing to accept that, given their real anathema, you know, and their whole mythology that they kicked out the kings originally.
Right.
That I think that he makes that possible, and that if he hadn't made that possible, then it is quite possible the Romans would have carried on with this cycle of civil wars. And if they carried on with that, well, who knows what would have happened, because as Caesar himself writes, the Gauls start to notice that there's this little distraction going on at home. And this is one of the things that inspires them to rebel in 52. So the whole Roman Empire, I think, might have collapsed a lot more quickly if the civil wars had continued to sort of bite away at the Romans. And I guess whether you think that's a good or a bad thing, depending, you know, your attitude towards Rome might colour that, and indeed your attitude towards empires. But it might have been a very, very different history.
And your attitude towards Christianity. I mean, if the Roman Empire isn't the Roman Empire in the early 4th century, then we don't end up with Constantine, and we don't end up with, you know, the next 1,500 years of Christian domination.
Yeah, well, it actually, you're quite right, and it's not really something I've thought about very much, but that it might have remained a fairly unimportant and localized religion rather than one that would have spread all over Europe and the Middle East and then worldwide. So things could have been very, very different. There you go. Caesar's responsible for the spread of Christianity.
Well, we've already talked about the fact that Jesus Christ is actually a thin imitation of Julius Caesar. There's one theory out there that we found amusing.
Well, it's the same initials, just like John Cleese.
Well, also, you know.
Well, I don't know, neither of you are British, so maybe you don't remember the sketch on Not the 9 o'clock News, which was a parody of all of the uproar about the Monty Python film, The Life of Brian, where it had this kind of alternative universe where instead of Christianity being the dominant religion, Pythonism was the dominant religion. And somebody had made a movie about a figure called Jesus Christ. And the Pythonists come on and say, this is terribly offensive. You're making fun, you're mocking our religion. The main figure in this film even has the same initials as our Lord John Cleese.
Well, that was an excerpt from the controversial and some would say scurrilous new British picture, The General Synod's Life of Christ. The film deals with the rise to fame and greatness of a humble carpenter's son named Jesus Christ. But many people have seen in the film a thinly disguised and blasphemous attack on the life of Monty Python. Python worshippers claim the film sets out to ridicule by parody the actual members of Monty Python, men who even today are worshipped and revered throughout the Western world. Now, Alexander Walker, what did you think of the picture?
Well, I was appalled. I mean, I actually find it deeply offensive that in a country that is still ostensibly a Python-worshipping country, that a 14-year-old child can actually get in to see this film. I mean, there is little enough proper Python around these days without parading this distorted garbage about.
Bishop, you directed the film. Did you expect this kind of reaction?
Well, I certainly didn't expect the Spanish Inquisition. Yes, I did direct the film, and I feel as though I must emphasize at this stage that it is not about Python.
Oh, come on.
I'm not a Pythonist. I'm not a Pythonist myself, but obviously I have a tremendous amount of respect for people like Alexander, who are.
Oh, come now. Come now, Bishop. I mean, the leading figure in this film, what is it? Jesus Christ. I mean, he's quite clearly a lampoon of the comic messiah himself, our Lord John Cleese. Even the initials, JC, are exactly the same.
He's as my personal savior and God. So I'm right there with that. I love that man.
Do you know John Cleese did a podcast on my old podcast network for a while?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Get out.
I've got a promo somewhere where I've got the saying, hello, this is John Cleese and you're listening to...
This is John Cleese and you're listening to the podcast network.
Awesome.
I'll have to pull it out for this episode. Rhiannon, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to chat to us today. I wanted to let people know that they can follow you on Twitter at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. They can listen to your Caesar podcast at podcast.blogs.latrobe.edu.au.
Wow. Wow.
Just look for the other Caesar podcast, yeah. I guess. Rhiannon. Yeah,
just type in other.
Rhiannon Caesar podcast. Anything else you want to plug? Books, talks, La Trobe University, anything?
Well, we're about to re-release those podcasts on SoundCloud when Matt gets a moment in his heavy schedule. And then we're going to put the Emperor podcasts out sometime towards the end of the year on SoundCloud too, and also I think via iTunes. So yeah, if you just search for my name on iTunes, things will come up. Many of my subjects, my courses at uni, are out there too, if you really want to get into the Romans and Roman literature. So I hope people will find things to enjoy.
Thank you so much, Rhiannon. And I'm going to play your outro music for you.
Thanks, Cameron. That was really fun.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for coming on, Rhiannon. Have a great day.
Take care.
Okay. Goodbye, Cameron.
Bye. Bye.
Goodbye. Hey, that reminds me. Hello? Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can. Hello, Ray. Okay.
Yeah, the next podcast series someone needs to do is the effect that charm has had on history. Someone who's got charm, who's charismatic, charisma, chemistry, whatever you want to call it.
You're talking about me again, right?
Yeah, well, I was trying to be subtle, but yes. But no, just the effect of charm throughout history. You know, someone can make you feel like they're just talking to you. Nice. Very nice.
Right. Well, there you go. That was Rhiannon Evans, folks.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah. Aussies are fun to talk to.
I liked her accent more than I like yours. Is that bad?
No. No, not at all. Tom Holland is our next VIP guest, I think, author of
Rubicon.
Mental blank. And then I think Mike Duncan's coming up after that.
Yes.
We were going to be chatting with Mike Duncan today, but he's down with the flu.
Yeah, so we've hope he gets better.
Push him back a couple of weeks. Right. That is the VIP show for today. Thanks for listening, boys and girls. Don't forget, plugs, lifeofcaesar.com/shop to buy your T-shirts and coffee mugs and stickers. lifeofcaesar.com/console if you want to become a... no, that's for the VIP show. You're already on that. lifeofcaesar.com/patron if you want to become a patron. Give us some bucks so we can help produce more of these things, do some new series on different historical characters. We've got planned to launch a whole bunch of things. What else do we need to plug, Ray?
Plans. Oh, and certainly check out Facebook. We try to keep that going, have a lot of fun. You never know when a random question with a gift will be coming out. And also the thing, the coffee mugs that I have been selling will end up on the main website, lifeofcaesar.com. So don't forget to check those out. That way you'll have like at least four different mugs to choose from, if not more.
And I'm also going to plug motherload.com.au, my consulting site. I've had a few people send me letters of interest after hearing about that.
Yeah.
So marketing consulting and what else? That's it.
Napoleon and World War II.
Oh, yeah. The Napoleon show, the World War II show. Yeah.
That was still my favorite, my first. I love that one.
Thank you, Ray.
Not mine, the Napoleon one. Sorry. Yeah.
Actually, we're gonna do a new episode, I think, next month with Andrew Roberts, who's got a new book out on Napoleon. Be the first episode we've done in 5 years, I think. He's got a theory that, he's got evidence that the British Crown was involved in the assassination attempt on Napoleon that directly led to him naming himself emperor.
Ah.
So there you go. Check one, two, check. See, now I know why that's funny.
Great movie, 1941. Everybody, check it out.
Thanks, Ray. Talk to you soon.
Yep. Take care.